Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inside Athletics Podcast. I'm Ben Harlow, and as you can probably tell from the title, it's a multi-event extravaganza special type episode today. We have husband and wife duo Ashton Eaton and Breanne Tyson Eaton, who are the biggest power couple in multi-eventing. It was a really interesting chat that I had with them. They talked a lot about their retirement post the Rio Olympic Games and then now pregnant. Breanne is expecting in February, which is super exciting, but they also reflect on a lot of their major competitions, unpicking some of the things that happen behind the scenes, and they kind of give us a little insight into what it's like being a part of the combined events field, what it's like being in the combined events room during a major championship, some of their favorite competitions, what they get up to outside of the sport and their early lives and how they met each other. They're both brilliant, brilliant people, so I hope you enjoy the episode.
We were just wondering, like, what's the time commitment? Because we're about to have a kid, and I don't know if we have any spare time for that right now. Yeah.
When are you expecting?
Beginning of February.
Oh.
Yeah.
How are you guys feeling?
Good.
Like, we need more sleep.
Yeah. I mean, if this is, like, a taste of what it's going to feel like, I'm a little bit worried. But I think...
I feel like I'm going to age a lot faster.
Yeah, John Malkin tweeted something yesterday about how having kids is... Or, like, prepares you for how you feel at world championships, just, like, not getting any sleep.
Yeah.
It's like, ay, ay, ay.
At least you're doing it, like, whilst pregnant, so
yeah,
maybe...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hardcore true. Training.
That's true.
Okay. So this episode, obviously, you guys are, like, a multi-eventing power couple, and we wanted to kind of focus it on the multi-event, so who better to speak to than you two? You've got... a really, really interesting story just as a couple generally, because it's so rare that within a couple that A, you're both doing a similar event, and B, you're both really successful at it as well. So you both went to the same college, right?
Yeah.
And how did you guys end up meeting?
We met in 2007 for the first time, and I was a freshman at Oregon. Breanne was a...
So first year university.
Yes, first year university, sorry. And Brian came on a recruiting visit, and we had met for the first time then. And we had, our first conversation was 15 minutes long. This is going back now. And I was just like, man, that was the best conversation I ever had with a girl. And you tell the rest of the story.
Yeah, we just had a lot in common. And then we went to Pan Am Juniors together in Sao Paulo in 2007. So I just graduated from high school, and Ashton just finished his first year of university. I already decided to go to Oregon at that point, and we hung out more there, and then I went to school in the fall and started dating pretty quickly after that.
Yeah.
So you guys properly kind of met in Brazil then, or had your first?
Well, no, we met in Oregon on my recruiting trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the first time. And then once she came to Oregon, like, we were in the training group together, and we just started hanging out more.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Nice one.
Friends first, then. Yeah. Started dating. First date was Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And you were both multi-eventers already at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you think that's kind of helped your relationship in a lot of ways?
I do, because I think we had a shared understanding. But I think we also had, like, because, yeah, a multi-event athlete, I think, has a certain mindset. Yeah, a shared understanding, shared interests.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think neither of us really knew what we were doing at that point, I guess. We were both really young. Had pretty much zero accomplishments. So I think we kind of grew up in the sport together. And that's, like, the sport has always just been, like, with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would have been very strange to not have each other, and, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Breanne, you grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts in Canada were you from?
Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And was being an Olympian always the target for you?
No. Not until I actually got to Oregon and watched the Olympic trials in 2008. It was the first time that I decided I wanted to go to the Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but you're already semi-training.
Yeah.
In college, my goal in high school was to get a college scholarship.
And then when she got there, I think once we both got there, we saw the 2008 Olympic trials, and we saw friends make the Olympics who were on the Oregon team, and realized for us, this could be a possibility in 4 years, because we knew these athletes as friends, and we were like, if they can do it, like, maybe we can do it too.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that you also, you looked up to Michael Johnson as well growing up.
Yeah, he was one of like the inspirations for me starting track. I think he inspired a whole generation because the golden spikes and all that was just something that everybody saw on TV. And the fact that he broke that world record doing that, I think helped also. But it was just, you're a young kid from the USA, and that was like a super big deal back then.
Mm-hmm. And had you grown up also not really sure whether you wanted to be an Olympian or not? Or
I mean, after I saw that race, I was like, what is he doing? And everybody said, he's in the Olympics. He's a sprinter. And I was like, I want to go to the Olympics. I want to do what Michael Johnson did. But I didn't know what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I actually knew that I wanted to try to pursue that was in 2008. So I didn't really grow up wanting to be an Olympian.
You guys are quite a fast turnaround, though, considering you've only really decided, okay, let's give this a go. And then you both were at the World Championships in 2009, right?
Yeah, a year later.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know a lot of European athletes start kind of specializing in one sport from a very young age. I really felt like I would have got burnt out quickly had I done that. I don't know if it just takes a special kind of person, but both of our careers were fairly short, and we felt like, you know, we put so much into it, and I don't know how people do it from like age 13, 14, 15. And so I think it was probably better for us to do a bunch of sports and not take it too seriously growing up, and then get more serious about it when we were 20.
Yeah.
I think you touched on an interesting point there, that you both did actually retire fairly young in athletics terms. You know, you've got, there was a world championship medalist who got a silver at 43 in the race walking, which is crazy considering. Wow. How old were you guys when you both retired?
28 and 27.
Yeah,
yeah, it is fairly young. What prompted the decision by you two?
Do you want to go first?
Go ahead.
For me, there was like kind of four reasons. I was getting injured more. There was no decathlete that I really knew of that was successful past 30. I kind of wanted to do other things in track. I felt like I accomplished all my goals. And yeah, well, I guess those were the three reasons, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the last reason was I wanted to pursue other things
while
I was still like fairly young and not be like 32 or something when I started another career, because I knew that would be the case. Like, we wouldn't just not do anything from our 30s onward, so.
Mine was just after Rio, we took 3 months off, and I just didn't feel like going back to training. It was never something I had experienced before. Normally I was excited to go back. And I just felt like I had accomplished everything I was going to. I couldn't put that sort of emotional and mental and physical energy into it anymore. And I know a lot of people have said, I think they retired too early. I think they could have still been, you know, done, you know, scored higher, accomplished more. And I just totally disagree with those people, to be honest, because I just, they have no idea, you know, they aren't us. They have no idea what it's like. And that in order to be good, you have to have like every piece of your life, like totally invested. And I don't think either of us could do it anymore. You know, we were excited for other things and wanted to start putting our eggs in other baskets, and knew that as soon as you did that, performances would drop off. And so I think it was just the right time.
I mean, you either retire on your own or your body tells you to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we saw athletes that we knew and respected, and they, you know, try to continue on and get hurt, and that was their victory lap. And if we knew we had a choice to have it our way or like keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think especially for Brianne, watching her from London 2012, where she got 11th, to Rio, the focus that, and discipline and like dedication that it took to go from that to from London to Rio, is like kind of not sustainable for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like it's unhealthy, but it's almost unhealthy to just be everything about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's not for us, it wasn't a physical thing. I think it was just more like a mental, and people say, like, man, you guys are at your peak, you're at your peak. And it's like, exactly. Mm-hmm. On the other side of a peak is a cliff. Like, that's the definition of a peak, is you have a downslope on both sides. Mm-hmm. So why go on, you know, why try to go find the other negative slope?
I think with athletics, it's such an interesting paradigm of how you can sacrifice so much of your, especially early young life, dedicating yourself to this one thing.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, for example, me, somebody who's not been an athlete and that kind of thing, I've lived a very different lifestyle, I'm sure, to what you guys lived growing up. And did you ever feel like you were, obviously you were missing out on other things, but did that play on your mind at all as athletes?
No, I didn't care about missing out on other things because I felt, I mean, I everything I needed in my life was like in track and field. Like I had, you know, my goals and community and friends, and you know, the hard thing was family, like not seeing them as much. But I think, but well, both of our families were so understanding about what we were doing that we never, you know, I never once felt like they were making me feel guilty for not being home for Easter or something like that. We'd always see them at Christmas, but and they would come visit us, and they would come also come to a lot of competitions, which was great. But it was also part of their life. And I know, I think both of our families had said, you know, when we retired, they obviously never told us this before, but they were like, the amount of stress in their lives has greatly reduced too, just because, you know, what they would know when we were injured and they would be worried for us or something wasn't going well, or they would sit in the stands and just sit there and bite their nails. Like they were, everything was totally out of their control. So.
Or they get questioned too. They get interviewed and other things, and like your life is exposed to people. To and there's no like training for that for family.
Yeah.
And people are like, hey, your kid is really good at stuff. Like, tell us about how, your life and their life. And it's like, stuff wasn't always great. What should I say?
Yeah.
Do I just say everything was cool, or should I say the real stuff? So anyway.
Yeah. But I think when we were training, I never once felt like I was missing out on something. Maybe part of that was because we were together, so we were missing out on things together.
I mean, in retrospect, I do feel like we did miss out on things. I mean, there was a couple, like, weddings I didn't go to who mm-hmm. were people I'd grown up with who were, like, really close, like Justin's sister and that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just stuff like that. You know, we got the invitation, and it's like, yeah, we'll be in Santa Barbara training. Can't take 3 days to go fly. So those are things that were just a result.
Yeah, a sacrifice you have to pay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, looking forward, you guys, you've been away from the sport for a few years now. Do you feel like you kind of had to start your lives again?
It's a good question. Yes.
Yeah, you totally lose your community.
Definitely.
I mean, you have to become a new person. I mean, you're like, our whole identity since we were 19 has been an athlete, pretty much.
But do you think you have to become a new person, or just kind of like find, like,
I guess find a new person is better, a better term. Or like find who you are next, what your next interest is.
Because you spend your whole day thinking and doing this certain thing. And then when you don't do that, you're like, well, what do I think about and do now? It's like, do I think about issues in the world? Do I think about, I mean, if you have like a passion, you care about something, sometimes it's easier to transition into stuff, but sometimes it's also not so easy.
Do you think that's something that's not talked about within elite sport enough, about what athletes are actually meant to do when they do retire?
Yeah.
Because obviously your whole, everything you know is this one thing.
I think the athletics community does a poor job of helping athletes with that or creating programs for that. I mean, I get it. There's no money in that. Like, there's no money. Maybe there is, but nobody has a passion for creating programs to help athletes transition. It's all about performance while you're in the sport. But it's a huge issue. I mean, going along with that is just like mental health, you know, people becoming depressed, not knowing.
Like, look at Michael Phelps.
Yeah.
Did you hear about his story from the US? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a big issue. I think, you know, some athletes handle it better and some athletes don't handle it well at all. I think especially those ones that are forced out of the sport.
For sure.
It's tough. And we've kind of gotten involved in San Francisco in a few communities, like retired athlete transition kind of communities. And we know some people who've been retired for 10, 12, 15 years and they're still really struggling. So it's actually kind of sad that happens.
Yeah.
That athletes are taken care of and then kind of just good luck, you know?
Like even, we've never met Noah Lyles until a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, about a month or two ago, I was thinking, whatever happened to Ashton and Brianne? Because we just, you know, kind of disappear, go away. And that's the truth. And sometimes at these like meetings we'll have with other athletes about their transition, one thing that was brought up was, you know, even if you just had a small ceremony that was like a send-off, it would almost make some people feel better.
Mm-hmm. Like closure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, we were talking to one athlete and they even said like an exit interview. They never got an exit interview.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what do you mean an exit interview? But then I thought, you know, somehow like when we retired, it was an ordeal and we did like literally a day of media, you know, and I felt like that was really closure for us. Like we were like not looking forward to that day because we knew it was going to be hard, but like it was a way of saying goodbye and saying our piece and saying why we were doing that. Some athletes literally, they retire and they put it on social media or however they do it. It's just like crickets. Like nobody cares, you know, it's just like, this was my life for so long and then just kind of faded out. And
yeah. It's almost like we could get all the other athletes together digitally or in some form, even like retired ones, and say, you know, good job, great career. Here's like some five things you can do now.
And resources.
Five people you can talk to type thing.
Mm-hmm. So,
I don't know how it is in Britain, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it can be fairly similar. Almost you guys were fairly lucky in the fact that you got to decide when your career's ended, whereas obviously some people do have career-ending injuries where maybe you aren't an Olympic medalist or whatever, and I guess you can just slip away, which, it's really difficult. Do you guys, obviously you Ashton, you're from Oregon, and you basically spent a lot of your whole life there, but you are now in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Is that, did the move to San Francisco, was that prompted by this, like, finding this new part of yourselves?
For sure. We had talked about moving, I think a little bit before retirement, but even once we decided to, we actually kind of drove around the western part of North America because we wanted to get out of Eugene and away from track for a little while. And so we went to, like, Colorado. We checked out some places in BC, Canada, San Francisco, and we thought about Seattle and all these other big cities. And in the end, I really liked San Francisco because of all the innovation and stuff there. And I thought, if we're going to be interested in business or other things, that would be the place to go. It was like startups and kind of like all this opportunity in action. So we had been there once on a date. Mm-hmm. And then we went to like a sponsor event there. And we were like, I think Brianna had brought it up. We walked out of a building. She's like, you know, what if we lived here? She's like, yeah, okay. So.
Was it that simple?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much. So we moved there in 2018 of October. No, 17 of October.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know anybody. And just started like networking. And we found some startups to join. And so Brianna has been at hers for like 2 years. She's helped build a health science company. And I did like a software startup for a year and ended up leaving because I wanted to do proper training for like science and technology. So I'm in school now.
Oh, wow.
So we both kind of found like, for at least for now, like a new path there.
What was both of your degrees in at university?
Mine was business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine was psychology.
Oh, okay. Interesting as an athlete and now business for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
How are you guys finding life in San Francisco? Obviously, Silicon Valley and all that kind of thing. It's a really exciting place to be, especially working in startups.
Yeah. I mean, the first year was wild. We like didn't know. We were meeting people, I feel like left and right, almost every week or month. And we were going to like these dinners where you would meet like the founder of Box. And you're just like, wow.
Yeah. Or we'd go to like a baseball game and be sitting next to the like literally the person who started YouTube.
Yeah, like Justin Tam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Because they're on like they are part of the U.S. Olympic Committee Foundation, so they like give money to help you know, fun U.S. athletes and stuff.
But I almost, like, equate San Francisco to the Olympic Village in a way. Like, when you're an athlete in the Olympic Village, this is why they don't let spectators in, because spectators would come in and want to take pictures with everybody and just kind of interrupt the whole ecosystem of the Olympic Village. But when you're in it, everyone's just kind of an equal playing field and nobody really bothers each other, you know? And that's kind of how Silicon Valley is. Like, I've been doing workout classes and just, like, been on the treadmill next to
Sam Altman.
Yeah, like, just these, I'm like, whoa, why don't you have bodyguards around you? But it's just like this, I don't know, this, like, little community of everyone just understands each other and leaves each other alone. It's kind of like LA with celebrities. Like, they, yeah.
I think it's been really good for us in our future, though, because just like a young athlete going to world championships, when you, before you arrive, you're like, oh my gosh, these athletes. And then when you see them and you compete with them, you're like, oh, they're just a person like I am. Mm-hmm. And it makes things like more tangible. Like, I could do that. Not to mention, I think there's language, just like sport has kind of its own language, and you can talk to fans and statisticians and things like that. Business and entrepreneurship and innovation, like all these things have their own kind of like language and understanding. And so I think we've both kind of learned that, which I think is helpful going forward.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of obviously your new jobs now, you are away from athletics. Is there any, do you guys see yourselves having any sort of future in track and field?
I do. Yeah, I think so.
For sure.
It's starting, like, that passion is starting to come back because we've taken a little bit of a break, especially with the Olympics starting up again. I don't know what that looks like yet, but probably start exploring that in the future once the baby comes and we kind of settle down and get our lives in order.
Yeah, for sure. I think for both of us, we worked together for many years, and it was doing something we loved, and we knew it was important to find something new, but our whole lives have been affected by sport in a positive way. I mean, every day I'm kind of like have a challenge or need to do something, I reflect back to like my training or a competition or some kind of example that sport has given me. And I think it's coming back to this meet has shown me just how important it is to me, but also I think in general for people, not just as like entertainment, but inspiration. And it could be like a symbol for health for a lot of folks, and the future for like young people as well. So I think whatever we do will be, you know, probably unique to us as well. But yeah, for now I think it's an exploration phase.
Okay. You guys obviously spent so much of your careers training together.
Yeah.
You were both coached by Harry Mara, and now obviously you are working in separate places. Is that weird, adjusting to being with somebody basically all the time to then going off and doing separate days?
I personally think it's a cool change. Like, the first year we were doing different things, it was cool because we always had like a story to tell at night. And I, you know, I just had no idea what her day was like, and she'd come home and talk about, you know, people at work and meetings and what they're building and her issues. And I remember I had some time off or something, and I went to, she helped build like this gym, this facility, this health science facility. And I went to go see it, and I was like, holy crap, like, you helped build this thing. That is insane. And she was running the show, man. Like, I remember walking in there and everybody was like, brand this, brand that, like, what do we do here? And it's like all these contractors contractors and like workers and people who are like actually designing and building this thing. And she was like in the middle of it all and like had it dialed in. And I was like, I am very proud of you. This is very cool. Mm-hmm. Like, this building will be here for however long, and like, you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
And normally I'm at the track and I'm able to see what she's kind of working on the building, and I didn't get to until it was almost done. So to me, that was very cool.
I read an interesting New York Times article on both of you. And I think it was prior to Rio.
Chris Cleary.
Yeah, and a lot of what kind of came up is how invested you are in Brianne's own career as well, or maybe sometimes even more than your own. How did you find that in track and field when you were actually both competing?
Why are you laughing?
Well, I mean, I think sometimes I think we were in more invested in each other's careers than our own.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember before Rio, Ashton was having quite a few injury issues, like just one thing after the other after the other. And he had to obviously do the U.S. Olympic trials, and literally, what, 2 weeks before was having like a hematoma drained from his quad because he had torn his muscle, you know. And I remember just like thinking, I can't do Rio without him, you know. Like it was just like his success would also determine mine, and it was almost like I wasn't going to be a complete athlete if he wasn't also, if his career wasn't also going well. I don't know if part of that is like a contributing factor of the fact that we started training together and we'd always competed with each other at every international competition, but I don't know. That's how I always felt, like, I'm not a complete athlete without him. If he doesn't make the team, what am I going to do? I'm not even going to know, like, what to do in Rio, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. For me, at least.
I think for us, it was just always wanting to help the other. And honestly, what we wanted for each other, I think, is what all multi-event athletes want for each other, which is why they're such a tight-knit group. You just want them to do well, and you almost, like, want to help them. Like, when Kevin no-hided in vault, or he was kind of, like, running, and you could tell that he was visibly hurt, I almost, like, wanted to run on the field and be like, dude, it's not worth it, man. Like, you don't have to prove anything to anybody type thing, you know? So you just want to help.
Mm-hmm.
And Brianne would see me struggling in the high jump, which she's really good at. And she would always be like, this, that, like just helping. And sometimes it wasn't even technique. It was just like, you got to take off, not take it so seriously. And so all these things were just, you invest a lot because you feel like you're in control of your own deal.
Mm-hmm.
And with the other one, you're almost out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just like, ah, you know, it's like hard to just sit back and watch.
You'd always think like, I wish I could take that frustration or that stress or that issue on and so I could figure it out so they don't have to do it, you know?
Yeah.
That was always, yeah. Because yeah, the being out of control was more stressful for me than just being able to like deal with it myself, if that makes sense. Although I know he was like totally capable of doing it. It just sucked to see him not be able to figure something out.
Yeah,
that makes complete sense. And, you know, people always speak about in the Maltese that there is such an amazing camaraderie. And I think that definitely was displayed in Doha as well. How did you guys find watching all of that play out?
I mean, for the decathlon specifically, it was a roller coaster. It was crazy. You were like, what is going on? And then you feel bad for the athletes because you know you've kind of been in those situations. And you're like, you just know how much they're beating themselves up. But you also know how okay it is, like on the other side, and it's like not that big a deal. So you're almost like, don't beat yourself up too bad. Don't beat yourself up too bad.
I mean, there was a span there in literally less than 10 minutes where Lyndon Victor fouled all three discus throws, and then Devin
Williams
didn't get a height in the pole vault, and then 2 minutes later, Kevin was up next and had his issue. And it was just like, I mean, I could have got, I had tears in my eyes for all of them. I was like, that, I mean, I know exactly what Ashton said, like, I know how, I don't necessarily know how that feels because those things haven't happened, but I know somewhat of the feeling of like, this, I can't do this, you know, or like I failed or, and yeah, it's just like, I kept thinking about Lyndon's coaches. I was like, I hope they go into that combined events room and just tell him like,
not the end of the world,
it's
man.
It's not the end of the world. You know, it's, I mean, this, we have another year because you know, the athletes are beating themselves up more than they should. And they need somebody to like calm them back down or make them tell them it's going to be okay.
It's quite interesting that you guys both said that because obviously people work themselves up so highly for the world championships. And at the end of the day, you both said it's actually not a big deal. It's just an athletics competition.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever use that when you were competing?
No. I mean,
easier said than done.
But I think that's what Ashton said, like, on the other side of it. That's why he said that. Like, now we're on the other side of it, and you see, like, it really is just... I mean, my sports psychologist used to say this all the time when I was an athlete. She'd say, try thinking of your life in, like, a linear bar, like, time. And you're, like... 30 years old now. Well, I was 27 at the time. Say you live till 80. Like, this one competition is like a pinpoint in your little timeline, and you think it's the end of the world. But if you zoom out and you think of like how you're going to live your whole life, like, it's really not the end of the world, you know? And at the time I was like, no, I am going to die if this doesn't go right. That's like literally how you feel.
Yeah.
Like, my life is just going to be over if this doesn't go how I want it to. And then you get on the other side of athletics and you're like, yeah, I didn't win one medal, but it's really, I mean, I used to say this, what happens if I, you know, invest 4 years of my life, like missing all of my friends' weddings, missing all the holidays, not seeing my family, not getting to see friends for 4 years, and this doesn't work out. And I literally didn't realize that it didn't matter if it had worked out until after I retired. Because it's like the whole thing is just about what you learn about yourself. But I don't think you can see that until you're on the other side of it.
And sometimes it's beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen athletes like Lyndon who can say after some time where they deal with it, but can say maybe in Tokyo, they like just have a PB in the discus. And they're like, you know what? It took that competition in... Doha to get me to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And obviously when you do have a really bad event, let's not even say you foul out or whatever.
Yeah.
When you go back into that multi-events, combined events, rest area, what is going through your head?
Sometimes not good things.
If you don't have a PB, you're saying?
Yeah, like if you foul out or...
I mean, you're...
crushed?
Yeah, it depends on how... I mean, I didn't even, in Daegu was my experience, and I didn't know height, but it was super bad. And I remember for 45 minutes, I was sitting actually at a table like this, and I was just staring forward. Coach would try to come talk to me, and I just didn't respond, like wasn't having any of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what I was thinking about. I was just pissed off. Actually, I was thinking I would want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was like the first, it was like, just start over. Get done with this whole damn thing, and let's just go home and forget about it.
How would you mentally prepare? Because with the multis, it's brutal. So you do an event, and an hour later, you're back out again.
Yeah, and you know what sucks? Especially if you get all these PBs, like leading up, like, yeah, things are going, and then boom.
Yeah.
You're healthy. It's like, ah.
That's the whole point of it. That's why it's so hard, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's the event. Yeah. I think that's why when you win, it's... or you do well, or you like score a point total that you want to. That's why I think it's so satisfying, because it's like, I did seven times or 10 times I like did what I needed to do, or I didn't do what I needed to do, but I came back. I was like able to like mentally flip and come back and like continue competing well. Like,
but these are the mental preparations.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you mentally prepare. You actually go through stuff like this and you beat yourself up, and then you try to figure out how to make it better. And if you do make it better, then you're like better prepared.
Yeah.
For next time.
Is there something that you do to psych yourself up for the next event particularly?
I think it's different for every athlete.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think some athletes need to relax, and I think some athletes, like Kevin, psychs himself up.
Yeah.
Does it really well with that.
And it depends on their career, like where they are. When you're younger, you kind of don't know what to do. And when you're older, you're like, okay, been through this before.
Yeah, I've read somewhere that some athletes, particularly in multi-events, were almost not caring, but trying not to care, you just do so much better.
That was a strategy for me, for sure. You know, once you start, I mean, every athlete's like this. You've trained for however many years. You obviously know what you're doing. You've done it right 100,000 times. You've done it wrong 100,000 times. And it's just kind of like, well, there's nothing else, like, at least for me, I would say, there's nothing else I can do at this point besides just relaxing and letting myself do what it knows how to, my body do what it knows how to do. And sometimes, well, for me, overthinking was just, especially in certain events, was just a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you start to overthink and then you start to doubt. And it's like really, the negative thoughts creep in a lot easier than the positive ones. And so if you let that start overtaking you, it's like, yeah, sometimes just don't think. Yeah. And it goes a little bit better.
I remember, again, the same New York Times article you spoke specifically about Beijing 2015 and how difficult that was for you. But on the flip side, when I remember watching that and thinking how brilliantly you were both doing, and it didn't even cross my mind, because you were, you know, both in medal positions, whatever,
yeah.
And it didn't even cross my mind what could have the mental turmoil you were going through during that period.
Mm-hmm. In hindsight, I saw it right from the first race, because she ran like a PB under 13 seconds in hurdles, and her eyes were like, that wasn't good enough. And yeah. I was just like, yeah, I knew. I did the same thing in Daegu, and I was like, it wasn't good enough. You have to go through those things, though.
Yeah.
What made you think that PB wasn't good enough? Or is it just comparing yourself?
Because I was
yourself?
Comparing myself to... I mean, I knew that my strongest competitor was going to be Jess, and she ran faster than me in the hurdles, and I fully went in there expecting to run faster than her in the hurdles. She was just coming back from having a baby. We competed together at Gutsis. You know, I kind of saw where she was at, which was stupid, you know, because she's obviously a phenomenal athlete. And not only that, but, like, I never compare myself to people. It was always, like, about your own thing. And so I just fully expected, like, I need to get as much of a lead as I can. And if I don't, then I'm in trouble. And when she ran faster than me in the hurdles, even though I PB'd, it was like, that wasn't good enough. Like, I couldn't let her beat me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Stupid. And then, like, now I look back at it, like, high jump is where it, kind of the wheels fell off. Or that was really the only event the wheels fell off on. And I jumped one bar lower than I normally do. And I literally thought it was the end of the world. Wanted to quit. Let's go home. This isn't worth it. You know, it's just like, what? What? Like, it's just so stupid. You know, you look back, you're like, I mean, you're, like, delusional. You're in the combined events room, and I was just like, let's go back to the hotel. Like, this is, I'm not going to get a medal. I'm not. And at that point, I was like, I went in expecting a gold medal, and I should have just went in, like, just do as best as you can do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just, yeah. So I get it. I get all this stuff, and
yeah.
For
a lot of athletes, I guess they have the core room, which is where a lot of the mental, psychological mind games happen, but in the combined events room, I kind of get the impression it's not that vibe at all.
No.
It's more of a supportive network.
Yeah, it's super chill in there.
I mean, you'll have
sometimes.
Yeah, you'll have some athletes are really excited. Some are laying there listening to music. Some are crying because they're mad about an event. Some are getting a stern talking to. Some are eating. Like, it's just, and everyone's just kind of in the same room. And in heptathletes and decathletes, it was interesting. You know, this time we went into the combined events room in Doha, and they were all kind of all together. Some of the heptathletes were mixed with the decathletes. It's like everyone's just kind of respecting each other's space and probably like, oh, yeah, I've been there. You know, like all the coaches are thinking,
yep,
I've done that, I've been there. And all the athletes are like, don't worry, like, it's going to be fine. You know, but even in, I don't know, even I find in, it's not just the call room, like, out on the field a lot of the time, we'll talk too, and it'll be, we could be talking about something totally not related to sport.
Yeah.
So.
It'd be funny to mic some people up.
Yeah.
Be a fly on the wall in those situations.
Yeah.
Be interesting.
I remember one time, it was in Beijing, and it was before the 400 meters. Enrico Freimuth from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember exactly what he was saying, but he's like, knew he was going into medal position or something like that. And he's like, I need to do this. And he said something, he was like, I must do this for myself. I must do this for myself. I'm just going to go. And I was like, damn right, man. And so he ran, I think, in my same heat or something. But I almost like took that mentality with me, and I was like, that's right. He I don't know, he just had such conviction, and you could tell it was like really important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, that's the attitude I want. And so I went out there and I ended up running the fastest time ever for myself. And I think it was that moment, because I was kind of like saying to myself, I'm going to run like 46 seconds or something normal. I was like, I feel tired and all this. But I was like, no, I must do it. So those kind of things happen in the call room. You know? Uh-huh. It's like, cool.
What's the weirdest thing you've had happen in the combined events area?
Oh, what have I had?
Well, think of all of them. Gutsis, and Eugene, anything. Yeah. Worlds, Moscow, anything.
I don't know if this is weird, but it was funny. In Gutsis, we were, they have locker rooms, and in the middle there's this big shower room, like a shared room with showers, and there's not a lot of room in the locker room, so physios will set their tape, like the massage tables, up in the shower, and the showers are, you know, pointing down, but no one's using them. And all the athletes are sleeping. There's about six of us just laying on the tables before the 800 sleeping, and someone was like trying to squeeze by the table in the shower and nudge the thing, and the showers turn on, and the athletes are like jumping. Shit, yeah, one whole side of it. That's like probably the only. I like wake up and there's people are screaming and jumping on the table. And,
ready for the eight now.
Yeah,
started early.
That's probably the only thing. I mean, I'm sure there are others, but that's the first one that comes to mind. But
mm-hmm. I didn't have the awareness before we retired to like take pictures and like document to the combined events room, because those are kind of the times I miss the most, I think. In Rio, we kind of like, I was taking pictures and stuff. Just because it's a cool place.
Yeah.
It's a very unique place that not very many people go into. And
yeah. It's like a special world that not many people understand.
Mm-hmm.
Was there particular people that you guys would hang out with in the combined events room?
It was always different. I feel like I hung out with my competitors more so when we were competing, like on the field. In the call room, you know, some people, everyone's kind of doing their own thing. Some people are wanting to rest and they have their eyes closed. Some people are eating. Some people are getting treatment. And you're always kind of sitting, you know, your coaches and stuff and your team get there and they like set up your little corner. So you're not always by the same people in the combined events room.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was more on the playing field.
Yeah.
That you would talk and get to know people.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. You spoke about Gotzes though, and you obviously both competed there.
No, I didn't. I got hurt.
Wait, did you not?
Yeah, I went and I got hurt.
Oh, yeah. All right, okay. Brianne, we'll go with you then.
Yeah.
How did you find competing in Gotzes? Obviously, it's really prestigious in terms of multi-eventing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you find
it? It's my favorite.
You won 3 years in a row?
I don't know if it was 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
I'm sad Ashton never got to. I mean, he got to see it at least, but it's such an easy place to compete. The fans are great, and it's just less stressful. The music, it's just more freedom. You know, like at the World Championships, if you're at an event and you're like, you're finished, say you're the first throw on the shot put, and then you have to wait till everyone else gets done, you all have to get escorted off. It's just more formal.
Mm-hmm.
It got this, everyone's walking around doing whatever they want. The coach is on the field, you know, just really relaxed. I like it a lot.
Where's your favorite place to compete, Ashton?
Jeez. I mean, my favorite place to compete, I think, was Hayward Field. I've had most of my best performances there. And it's also, like, really easy. The fans understand that thing. And so that was very, very helpful. I think Gutsis is my favorite meet to watch. Probably would have been one of my favorite to compete at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
And now, obviously, we've seen some amazing performances here in Doha in the multi-events. What do you both think of the current fields?
I mean, the tough one's good. I'm glad. Wow. If I'm being completely honest. Yeah, I mean, I was so happy for Kat, because I know, you know, talking about just like ups and downs in the heptathlon, she got no jump in the long jump in Beijing in 2015. So she could obviously speak to what that feels like. She was totally defeated in 2016. You know, she talked about like, maybe I shouldn't do the heptathlon anymore. Maybe I should just high jump. It just isn't working out for me. And so I was really happy to see her you know, win a gold medal and break the national record. I mean, it's been a long time coming, and she's obviously really talented. And I think now, you know, she made the decision to switch coaches, which has obviously served her well, and mm-hmm. she seems more confident and relaxed. And yeah, I she's going to do well in the future. And then obviously Nafi, it's going to be a battle. And there's a lot of young athletes. I mean, a lot that I haven't competed against that are now up and coming. So it'll be interesting to see. It seems like that kind of third place right now is wide open. I mean, they're all open, let's be honest, but kind of a spot to kind of somebody to fill in there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the same for the men. You have Kevin, who's dominant. You have Damien, who's got a lot of experience and very good and more potential. And then you have some young athletes who are competing very mature. Nicholas Calls, we saw one. Michael Wiebo, who's been around for a long time, but now is finally kind of coming into his own. And I don't know if it's just because he's been out of university a couple years and able to kind of focus on training. The German team, I think, has a good contingent, and they kind of, I think, always help each other rise. So we'll see how Kai Kazmierik does. But, also Lydon Victor. He's changed coaches, his situation. I think everybody, this is probably like everybody's first time really seeing their level at a major championship, who all the, like, the players are going to be in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're... Now it's kind of like, okay, we kind of saw where everybody was at and what they could work on and what they can improve in. And I think that's going to inform their training going forward. So I think if everybody's healthy, like, we could see one of the best decathlons ever in Tokyo just by looking at the top nine and their scores.
Mm-hmm.
They could be super high. So I think it's a good era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really seems that way. And, well, in the women's was a great battle as well, given that we've kind of spoken about it already, but how having that one event can really knock you, especially someone like Kat, who's kind of struggled to pick herself up. When you nail all the events in a row, does that, if you're, say, I don't know, if you've only got two events left to go and you've nailed them all, is that more pressure on, or is it just...
No, because if you're nailing them, you're, like, on a high.
Yeah, you're ready. You're like, yeah, just keep rolling.
Yeah.
And do you, well, I think with like Nafi and Kat, did you think that, obviously Nafi was watching Kat continually, maybe set PBs and that kind of thing. Do you watch your competitors at all?
I try not to.
Depends.
But sometimes it was hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Nafi's always got her eye on Kat just because she knows. And now she really will. But like, I remember Rio not really knowing anything that Kevin was doing until the high jump. Because mm-hmm. I was like thinking, hey, Damien and I will kind of battle. I knew Kevin was there, but I didn't know he's making such big improvements. And I was like, holy crap, this guy's PB'd in 3 of 4 events so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of are just focused on your deal.
Mm-hmm. How aware are you of your competitors' PBs and that kind of thing?
I mean, you're there. It's not like you're closing your eyes and plugging your ears every time anyone does anything, so you know. But you just try as hard as you can. At least I did try to just focus on my own thing. Like, I couldn't control what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other hard thing is, like, sometimes you're good friends with them. So when they do well, you're like, yes, like, I'm happy for you. But now I'm freaked out. Because I have to, you know, so yeah. I don't know. It's like there's like a balance of it.
But there's also, it makes a great competition.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're jumping at bars and... everybody's cheering for them, and it's like, you're up next. And you know, when people know it's like a competition,
mm-hmm.
then they're like cheering for you, and you're like, yeah, and you clear a bar. I found that to be super helpful in Rio, because like, even the whole French team would start clapping for me, and I was like, thanks guys, this is like super helpful. That's nice.
Yeah, it kind of seems, especially when there's only a few of you left, for example, in the high jump or whatever, everybody's just cheering everybody on.
Getting into it, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. I guess my final question would be, looking ahead to Tokyo, for each of you, who would you say is the key one to watch in each event?
In each event?
Yeah, so you can both do a half and decathlon prediction.
I mean, it's tough to say in a year because injuries and whatever else.
Let's just assume everybody's healthy.
I think Nafi's going to come back from this with a lot of fire. just because I think she's going to be not wanting to lose again. But I also think Kat has been with this training group for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she can learn a lot still the Olympic year and make some big improvements. And we've already seen that happening in the throwing events, which are the two that she really kind of needed to fix. I literally wouldn't know who to put my money on between those two. I mean, they're going to, I would for sure put them one and two. Caroline Schaefer, the German who wasn't here because I think she was injured.
Mm-hmm.
She's very good. So I might put her third.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, I don't know some of these younger athletes and
yeah.
their potential at all, how old they are, you know, any of their strengths and weaknesses. So it'd be tough. And I think for the decathlon, I mean, I think Kevin is going to come back. I think Kevin will win. I just think he's going to come back from this again with, like, not wanting to have that same thing happen. I think Damien is going to come back stronger. Because, yeah. again, he listened to some interviews, and I think he's ready to get going for Rio or for Tokyo and not wanting to. He wasn't satisfied here, I know. Then I don't know. I mean, Nicholas is very good.
Seemed to be, yeah, getting better.
Then you have Lyndon who didn't finish. You know, it's, I don't know, the deck is, I think the deck is much tighter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the heptathlon is the same. You have two different athletes, and Kat reminds me of Kevin, where you're just kind of like consistent. And maybe the high jump is a standout event, but it's more, she's just like dialed in and everything. Where Nafi has like a crazy javelin, and she can jump 202 if she wants. And
really good shot put.
True. So, but I feel like she's more, because she has like a kind of a slower 200, slower hurdles, slower 800. So she's more, she reminds me of me, where there's like a few events you're like good at, and the other ones you're kind of just kind of trying to maintain and maybe improve a little. So that's a battle there, because those two ways of competing, it's kind of like hard to tell.
Yeah, I think that's like a model for a heptathlete and a decathlete. You kind of have the more power-based.
Yeah.
You have the more like, I don't know, sprinty, runny type
yeah. base. And then for the men, if Kevin's healthy, I mean, the guy can score more points than 91 still. So, but Damien has a lot of potential. He's jumped 8 meters. He's thrown the shot put by 15, which we saw here. He's thrown the discus 50 meters. I've seen him throw 65 in javelin. And pole vault is the only one where he's got the potential, both in long jump and vault, to like jump and do way better. So if Damien fulfills his potential, I think it actually could be very tight
mm-hmm.
between him and Kevin, like very tight. And then that next position, some consistent athletes, like some decathletes, like Weibo and Call, we'll see what happens in the year, but, oh man, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to call.
Okay, cool. Well, I think we can leave it there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, guys.
No,
it's our
problem.
Pleasure.
That is all we have time for this episode of the Inside Athletics podcast. But if you did enjoy it, please rate us on whatever platform you are listening on. It really helps us out a lot. And if you have any other athletes or topics you want us to discuss, please feel free to reach out to us on any IWF platform or comment on whichever platform you are listening on. Or you can reach out to me directly at _BenHarlow on Twitter. Yeah, so that is it for this episode. Again, thank you so much for listening. If you've made it all the way through, well done. And I will see you in a month's time.